Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Science, Technology, and Society. I'm your host, Lance Turner. Today I'm going to be talking with Professor Daniel Nemser about his book, Infrastructures of Race, Concentration and Biopolitics in Colonial Mexico, out from the University of Texas Press in 2017. Daniel Nemser's Infrastructures of Race examines the long history of how Spanish imperial rule depended upon spatial concentration to control populations and consolidate power. Through four case studies spanning nearly 300 years of Spanish rule in colonial Mexico, Nemser illustrates how different modes of concentration, from centralized towns to disciplinary institutions, segregated neighborhoods, and general collections, reflected the prerogatives and imperatives of domination and expropriation. Compellingly, Infrastructures of Race argues that these spatial infrastructures and strategies were central and instrumental in the creation of racial identities and their inscription upon colonial subjects. Through designed and engineered spaces, racial identities were lived, sensed, and experienced, and as the built environment faded into barely noticeable infrastructures, race as well became naturalized. I'm very pleased to be sharing with you my interview with Professor Nemser, and I hope you enjoy it. Professor Daniel Nemser, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so this is a fascinating book, and I was wondering if you could tell me first a little bit about its genesis, how it came together.
It's funny looking back on, I think, any of these kinds of projects and trying to tell the history of where it came from, because I think when you kind of narrate that story, it ends up sounding a little bit more coherent than it was during the process. If I had to give like one version of the story, what I would say is basically, so I went to grad school at UC Berkeley, and my PhD is in Hispanic languages and literature. So I'm a literary cultural studies person, although I also worked with historians in grad school, and so I have a kind of a historically informed project. And the dissertation that I ended up writing when I was in graduate school was focused on the concept of mixture and purity. Obviously, the sort of concept of mestizaje or racial or cultural mixture is really important in Latin American studies, especially for folks who are working on more contemporary periods. But the idea that, Latin America, Latin American identities were constituted through processes of mixture that began with the conquest. And what I was interested in when I was writing my dissertation was the kind of to try to show that or think through the way that mixture and purity are actually produced. They're socially constructed rather than being kind of self-evident or obvious categories. There's a kind of a, for example, just kind of a conventional storyline for thinking about mixture in the history of Latin America, that it sort of begins with the conquest when Spaniards and Indians come together and meet. From there, it kind of unleashes a process of mixture that happens over the course of, the next 500 years. But looking back at that history, if you think, critically about it and approach it sort of from the perspective of, not really not trying to take for granted what mixture and purity are. And you start thinking about, you know, how is it that certain kinds of objects or certain kinds of people come to be defined as mixed or come to be defined as pure? Then you can start sort of breaking down those processes, breaking down those categories, and seeing how they end up being produced historically. And so the dissertation was really focused on this kind of trying to approach the concept of mixture and purity critically by looking at a number of different moments in the history of colonial Mexico. And as I started kind of revising the dissertation in order to turn it into a book, which was a kind of a long process, which involved writing a lot of new stuff and heavily editing pieces of the dissertation, what I kept on coming back to was the idea that that what I was really looking at when I was talking about mixture and purity was about sort of the relation between race and space. Because if you think about, you know, mixture and purity, for example, in a way, you could kind of define them as the arrangement of objects or bodies in space, right? Depending on how proximal or distant they are in some sense, or how you group them together to make coherent categories. I happened to, while I was sort of thinking through these questions and kind of starting to work on developing the book, I also ran into a kind of a new field of scholarship that's coming out of departments or disciplines like anthropology especially, but other disciplines as well, a kind of a critical scholarship on infrastructure. I'm sure we'll talk probably more about this later, but this scholarship on infrastructure really sort of highlights the relation between kind of materiality and subjectivity, materiality and the practice of everyday life. And so I found this concept really useful for developing this project that had originally started out being focused on sort of the abstract concept of mixture and sort of turning it into a project that was focused around the idea of spatial concentration. And so what the book looks at is this kind of long history of spatial concentration as a key practice or technique of colonial governance in Mexico specifically, but also in Latin America more generally. And I kind of look at the way that different kinds of concentration projects were used and deployed and their effects, the effects that they had over the long course of Spanish colonial rule in Mexico.
Yeah, right. And in the book itself, you frame it by beginning with this infamous character of Cuban history, General Valeriano Weyler. Why do you begin with him, and how does that kind of set this up?
Yeah. So this general Valeriano Weyler he's a Spanish general who sent to colonial Cuba at the end of the 19th century. During the War of Independence that Spain fought against Cuban rebels. And the reason that I start the book with this anecdote is that this guy is seen as the kind of, the kind of creator of the concentration camp. A lot of historians who've looked at the concentration camp and have tried to kind of historicize the emergence of the concentration camp, rather than kind of assume that, say, you know, the concentration camp that we see in, say, Nazi Germany is this kind of weird exception that is just kind of the appearance of evil on the world stage. A lot of historians have looked back and tried to trace a kind of a history of concentration camps, and a lot of them have come to the conclusion that the concentration camp that we know of and that we're most familiar with, you know, maybe from the sort of Nazi experience, although it's obviously been deployed widely by lots of different states, actually begins in the colonial context. And so a lot of historians have pointed to the Spanish use of the concentration camp. They actually called them campos de reconcentración or reconcentration camps in colonial Cuba between 1896 and 1898 as a kind of an origin story for the concentration camp. And the reason that this is important is because it shows the kind of colonial the colonial character of the camp, that it has to do something with the kind of exceptional character of the colony, the racialized character of the colonial other, and so on and so forth, that then only later can be kind of boomeranged back to Europe and deployed in Nazi Germany, or, for example, in the United States with the Japanese internment camps during World War II. And so the reason that I start the book with this anecdote is because if, you know, you see at the very end of colonial rule in the Americas, this is, you know, this war between 1896 and 1898 that Spain fights with the Cuban rebels ends up being the kind of nail in the coffin in a lot of ways of Spanish empire. At the end of this conflict, Spain loses its last three kind of main colonies, Puerto Rico, Cuba, and the Philippines, to the United States. So there's this kind of emergence of the concentration camp at this kind of last moment of Spanish colonialism kind of begs the question, if the colonial character of the concentration camp is key to its emergence, why is it that it only emerged at the very end of this long colonial project that lasted for 400 years? And so my book kind of begins with this anecdote to kind of pose the question a different way and suggest that maybe there's actually a longer history of concentration or concentration projects in Latin America that start from really from the 16th century. And that when at the end of the 19th century, when the Spanish army is deploying the concentration camp as a sort of counterinsurgency strategy against Cuban rebels, rather than inventing something completely new, what they're actually doing is drawing on this kind of long history of repertoire, this long repertoire or deep repertoire of practices that the Spanish had been using for, you know, hundreds of years before that.
Yeah. Before we go back to Hernan Cortes and the conquest of Mexico, I'd like to ask you a little bit about infrastructure and why it's particularly useful for studying racial identities and what it lets us see that we can't see otherwise.
Yeah. So the concept of infrastructure, I really came to it through, as I kind of mentioned before, this new scholarship in fields like anthropology and geography and history and other fields as well. But a lot of those fields are kind of the central places where it's been taken up. And the idea is that infrastructure is not so much, or in these, from these perspectives, these disciplinary perspectives, infrastructure is approached not as a technical concept. It's not like a question of like, how do you build a bridge in order to make it not fall down? But obviously more as kind of like a critical approach to infrastructure and what it does, the way that that infrastructures kind of create a substrate or architecture that enables the practice of everyday life. And because infrastructures kind of create these systems that let us live in a particular way, they also end up often coming to be taken for granted. And that's especially the case because infrastructure is often located kind of beneath the surface of the phenomenal world. Infra obviously means beneath. And so we don't always think about the networks of pipes and wires and the electricity grid and the stuff that's underneath the road and the roads themselves, right, that enable us to live the kinds of lives that we live today. When you walk into a room, you flick on the light switch and you don't think about all the stuff that's going on in the background to make that electricity come to the room and make the light work. There's a kind of cliche that goes like you only notice infrastructure when it breaks. And what that kind of points to is this kind of backgroundness, the kind of normalization or naturalization of the modes of life that infrastructure enables. And so in this sense, there's a kind of material substrate that includes, you know, everything from, I don't know, roads and walls and ditches and buildings and boundaries and, you know, pipes and wires and all this stuff, canals, that enable the way that enable how we live and act and think in the societies that we live in and that we create. And so the reason that this is useful for me is because it helps to not only point to the way that colonial Mexican society was organized in order to, you know, extract labor, for example, or extract resources, but also the way that bodies and communities and populations were controlled, and also the way that those communities came to kind of understand themselves. So the first reason, I guess, would be the kind of material character, the material character of infrastructure. And maybe the second characteristic of why infrastructure is a useful concept for me here is to think about the way that race can itself act infrastructurally. And so if on the one hand I'm trying to argue that the material organization of material organization of colonial life is part of what enables the emergence of categories like racial categories, subjectivities like racialized subjectivities, then on the other hand, it may be useful to think about race as itself operating infrastructurally in a sense as well. So if you think about infrastructure as a kind of a system that enables the operations of other systems, sometimes it's, you know, we tend to think about infrastructure as sort of encompassing physical objects, right? Like as a lot of the examples that I've mentioned so far are, you know, things like pipes and, you know, I don't know, the electricity grid. It doesn't necessarily include people, but some critics have kind of taken a step back and thought of infrastructure in a kind of a, I guess, more expanded sense, where people can participate in those sort of enabling systems. And, you know, in certain ways, it becomes difficult to kind of figure out what counts as infrastructure and what doesn't count as infrastructure. And so it depends on your approach to it. To the extent that people can serve it as kind of enabling, as part of an enabling system that enables other systems to function, then you could start to think of like race as operating infrastructurally to the extent that it facilitates the extraction, for example, of resources or the accumulation of capital or particular practices of domination in a particular society. So on the one hand, race is produced by the infrastructural organization of colonial Mexico, right? This is kind of the main argument that I'm trying to make in the book, that race is a product of the way that bodies were organized in space materially. But then on the other hand, I'm trying to suggest that race, once it sort of starts to be constituted, itself starts to function infrastructurally in the sense that it enables systems of domination and accumulation to continue into the future.
Mm. So then if we go back to following on that, if we go back to, you know, the earliest days after the conquest or after the fall of Tenochtitlan, you know, what is the spatial situation look like to the Spaniards as far as how they're going to rule this territory, this former empire of the Aztec?
Yeah. So there's a couple of things to keep in mind about this, but I think one of the most important things to think about, to recognize, is that when the Spanish arrive in what they called New Spain or colonial Mexico, and they started to kind of think about how they were going to govern this territory, one of the biggest obstacles that appeared to them was the fact that according to them, indigenous communities were really spread out. They were very dispersed. And this problem of dispersion appeared as one of the sort of most significant problems for Spanish colonial rule. The reason that they saw it as a problem, I mean, there's a couple of kind of pretty obvious reasons, right? One is that it's harder to control people if they're spread out. And you have to keep an eye on people who are living in communities that are really dispersed, that are maybe located in sort of unfavorable terrain in mountains or in forests, something like that. It's also hard to extract resources from them, extract labor and tribute payments from a colonized population if they're, you know, living very far apart. It's also, for the Spanish, it was really important to oversee the sort of Christianization of the indigenous population. And so it's harder to oversee their spiritual growth, right? And make sure that the indigenous population is continuing to do the Christian practices that they've been, that have been imposed on them. If they're living really far apart and spread out and in these difficult to reach places. So for the Spanish, from really early on in the 16th century, they start to see the dispersion, this supposed dispersion of the indigenous population as a huge problem. Now, there's another question that's important, which is, you know, whether dispersion was actually something that characterized the indigenous population when the Spanish arrived. And I think it's important to recognize that a big part of what the Spanish talk about is that has to do with their expectations, more maybe with their expectations than what was actually there. But what the Spanish, you know, saw was something that didn't necessarily live up to what they imagined as, you know, civilized life. And so whether or not the dispersion was a real feature of indigenous life in colonial Mexico when the Spanish arrived, the Spanish perceived it to be a really big problem. Even in the places where there were, you know, sort of concentrated populations, like in Mexico City, for example, after the violence of the conquest, you know, which involved a lot of just destruction and death, there was a kind of an emptying out of the population. That obviously that didn't completely empty out the population. There were still millions of indigenous people left, but the combination of war, violence, exploitation, and so on and so forth really had a massive impact on the indigenous population of colonial Mexico. And so, in a way, what I'm trying to say is that the Spanish both perceived a certain kind of dispersion in indigenous territory when they arrived, but they also materially produced a sort of dispersion or emptiness through their violent policies, that then they kind of realized or decided that they needed to kind of fix through a kind of concentration project by gathering together the indigenous communities into orderly or centralized towns.
And so what can you describe these towns and what their plan and structure was?
Sure. So the first chapter of the book talks about this project, this kind of, maybe you could call it an initial project in the history, the long history, the long genealogy of concentration in colonial Latin America. It was called Congregación or Congregation. And essentially what its objective was to forcibly centralize indigenous communities and bring them together to live in these orderly planned sort of towns that were laid out on a grid of streets. And they were, designed in order that all of the houses in the community were supposed to be within, you know, hearing distance of the church bell. And they were measured and sort of calculated in a sense that it would be easy to keep track of, like, how many people were living in the community so that you'd be able to calculate and extract tribute or labor more easily from those communities. And the houses, even according to, you know, what the Spanish were intending to produce on the ground, the houses that they wanted the indigenous people to live in were supposed to have very similar characteristics. There was supposed to be a certain number of rooms for children and adults, rooms for boys and girls. You know, so there was a kind of a sort of a disciplinary project of segmentation that was built into even the architecture of the houses that were put together in these communities. Now, part of what's complicated about this history is that the indigenous people, especially the Nahuas, who are the people who we sort of generally call the Aztecs today, had towns that were organized around what they called altepet, which was a Nahuat word that kind of means water and mountain, but it was used to kind of refer to these kind of city ethnic states, or these cities, kind of like city state kind of things. Very hard to define the term or translate the term into English. There's a lot of historians or ethnohistorians who've looked at this, these altepet. What they've sort of talked about is that one of the things that they found is that these towns were actually split up into different little towns, that were organized together in a kind of a non-hierarchical way. So an altepet might be made up of, you know, a certain number of little towns that were spread out over a somewhat wide territorial space. In fact, there may be towns that were interspersed with each other over a single sort of territorial unit that might belong to different altepet. So when the Spanish arrived, they saw that these towns, they thought of the towns in a particular way. They interpreted what they saw on the ground in a particular way. And they essentially ended up kind of creating a hierarchy where they would say, well, the littler towns must be the ones that are dependent on or subject to the bigger towns. Whereas the Nahuas, Nahua communities were organized in non-hierarchical ways where the kind of rule would rotate from community to community, from sort of constituent unit to constituent unit. The Spanish, when they arrived, they kind of imposed a hierarchy on these towns and decided that the bigger ones usually were the kind of ruling or head towns. They called them cabeceras or head towns. And the littler ones were subject towns. So the head towns came to have certain rights and certain advantages that were not given to the subject towns. So why is this important? Well, it's important because it shaped the way that this project of concentration played out on the ground. One of the ways that congregation happened was by, grouping together some of these littler towns into one sort of location, whether it was one of the already existing bigger towns or whether it was in a completely new town that was in a valley, more accessible valley, so that it would be more accessible to the Spanish. People, communities from different altepet were gathered together in these centralized towns. And even when communities from the same altepet were gathered into one centralized town, there were still ways in which this process of centralization or concentration produced spaces that were understood or were felt as kind of like mixed spaces. That's because, as ethnohistorians have found, a lot of times these not only did altepet have their own kind of identities attached to them, their own ethnic gods, their own ethnic sort of senses of self, but also a lot of the constituent units of the altepet had a similar sense of identity. And so when the Spanish started to group these sort of little towns together, they ended up bringing together people who thought of themselves as maybe belonging to different sort of identities, right? As having different kind of senses of who they were and who their communities were. Sometimes they even spoke different languages. So there were people who spoke Nahua who were brought together with people who spoke other indigenous languages, in particular parts of central Mexico. And so once they were gathered together, part of what my argument is that these older identities started to kind of break down within this new context for a lot of complicated reasons. But basically, it had to do with which kinds of communities could have access to special privileges. And so people in belonging to some of the smaller communities ended up starting to separate themselves off from the Atepet that they had previously belonged to in order to claim the kind of head town status. And overall, this process of gathering the communities together contributed to the decline of the Atepet as a way of organizing identity, and ended up being replaced by a kind of a more generalized sense of Indianness or indigeneity that the Spanish imposed on the indigenous population through practices like forced labor and tribute, which were these obligations or that the Spanish applied to the indigenous population as a whole. So to take a step back, the argument is basically that this congregation project, while it on the one hand kind of organized indigenous life, it aimed to produce these towns that were well ordered, that could be easily governed, that could be easily subjected to spiritual oversight, that from which resources and labor could be very easily extracted. They also contributed to the emergence of a new indigenous identity, the emergence of the Indian as such, that was not only a category that was imposed onto people, but that people could come to understand themselves as fitting into. And so there was this kind of, I guess you could call it a subjective effect of this concentration or centralization project that was kind of the basis of Spanish colonial rule for many years.
Right. And so there's a lot in this book, and I know we're not going to have time to get to all of it, but hopefully we can. But one thing I want to get to is the important material in chapter 3 about the riot of 1692. And this is important because it's when it's sort of the inverse in a certain sense of what's going on with the congregations where the racial structure, at least for a moment, sort of collapses. Can you explain that and what that reveals about this imbrication of infrastructure and race in the empire?
Yeah. Okay. So there's the third chapter of the book looks at this riot that happened in Mexico City in 1692, and the kind of aftermath of the riot. So to take a step back, Mexico City, after the conquest, was arranged in a sort of on the basis of segregation, a kind of a segregated sort of cityscape. And in many ways, segregation had the same kind of foundation as the project of congregation, which was that the indigenous population needed sort of to be cared for and protected. And the Spanish, you know, they thought of their sort of colonial rule as caring for the people that they were sort of dominating, right? And that they were, helping them become, helping them live better, helping them become sort of civilized and helping them become Christian, which was, you know, for them, according to them, it was really the best thing that you could do, right? And so there was this idea in the congregation, in the congregation policy, that congregation was actually for the indigenous people's own good. It was for their benefit to be brought together to live in these orderly towns. And the same was true of Mexico City. So it was organized on a segregated plan where the center of the city was supposed to be for Spanish people to live. And the districts that surrounded that this central part of the city were supposed to be for the indigenous population. And they were organized, they were broken down into parishes. So each Indian parish, you know, had a priest that oversaw it, or had priests that oversaw it. And they were supposed to be dedicated just to kind of seeing to the Indian spiritual health. And the Spanish in the center of the city had other parishes, belonged to other parishes. And so the city was kind of organized on this segregated plan. Now, obviously, in practice, life wasn't segregated. And especially over time, lots of people who weren't indigenous, you know, ended up moving into the indigenous districts, and lots of people who weren't Spanish ended up living in the center, the kind of Spanish center of the city. So in 1692, there was this really massive riot that happened in the center of Mexico City, where tens of thousands of people, looted the marketplace that was located in that central plaza. Today it's known as the Zócalo. Really, really big central plaza. At that time it had a market in the center. So the marketplace was completely looted. The viceroy's palace, which borders on one side of that plaza, was destroyed. And the Spanish really, lost control of the city. And in a sense, they lost control of the colony. For a very short time, but it was really significant, especially for them. Looking back on it, they really were impacted by this event. And so, in the wake of the uprising of the riot, there's all of this kind of textual production by the colonial authorities and by colonial elites who are trying to figure out what went wrong, how could this have possibly happened. How could the Indians have risen up and attacked us and had so much success in destroying all this stuff and challenging our authority? By figuring out what the causes of the riot are, we can also figure out how to prevent them in the future. And so it turns out that what ended up being kind of like the main cause that was identified in the aftermath of this riot was essentially mixture. It was essentially that the people who were supposed to be living in the indigenous neighborhoods had actually kind of like infiltrated into the center of the city, and that it was this unruly kind of like mixed population that was living in places where they were not supposed to be living that had ended up causing the breakdown of this infrastructure of segregation that had ruled for a long time, for had been there for since the beginning of Spanish colonial rule. So in a sense, if congregation, the centralization of these indigenous communities is the kind of represents the point of creation or the moment of creation of this kind of like segregated infrastructure that lasts for a couple of hundred years, this is the moment where it breaks down, or it's at least the moment that it's recognized as breaking down by the Spanish authorities. And there's a kind of a recognition that something has to be done either to reimpose segregation or to replace it. And so the Spanish authorities asked a number of the colonial elites, including the members of the religious orders who were the heads of the these indigenous parishes in the outer districts of Mexico City, and also this colonial intellectual named Carlos de Sigüenza y Góngora, who's really well known in colonial Mexican studies because he wrote and published a lot of really interesting works. In a lot of different genres, everything from like astronomy books to history. He was really interested in indigenous history, kind of more directly administrative documents, like the ones that I look at in this chapter, which is basically kind of a proposal for segregating or resegregating the city, for reproducing the kind of purities, right, on which the foundation of Mexico City had been based. And so Sigüenza, what he does is this intellectual, he kind of draws a line where he says that the Spanish government should say, basically all of the Indians that live within this line, this central district, need to move back out, need to leave by a certain date. And that way we can secure the kind of Spanish character of the center of the city. And it doesn't matter who who lives in the districts, right? All the, indigenous people, but also everyone else who isn't Spanish, right? Who isn't white, can live there as well. And so he kind of writes this proposal for segregating the city in that way, in a way trying to secure the purity of the Spanish center, the Spanish core of the city. On the other hand, the religious figures also agree completely with segregation. They think that the riot was caused by mixture, by the breakdown of segregation, and so they want to resegregate the city as well. But for the religious actors, it's not so much the purity of Spanishness that they want to save through resegregation. It's the purity of the indigenous population that they want to save. So for the heads of these indigenous parishes, these Indian parishes, they also support segregation, but they call for everybody who's not Indian to be moved to the center of the city, of Mexico City. So they want to kind of bring the Indian districts back to the way that they supposedly were at the beginning of the Spanish colonial project. And that way, the Indians will be, free from the negative influences of the other races, right? And in the end, these religious figures who end up developing these new technologies of kind of population control and tracking, in a sense, that ends up serving as a kind of a new way of imposing segregation in the wake of the riot. So these religious actors, in order to kind of like generate their proposals and do research on like how many members of their parishes are actually living in the center of the city, they go out and do these kind of walking tours, and they write up these like censuses sort of, where they say, there's like at this address in the center of the city, there's like these families with this number of people, who have these jobs and they're this old. And they kind of create a lot of data, of where the members of their parishes are living outside the parishes. These documents are called padrones. They're kind of like these proto-censuses. And in a way, the padrones end up serving as a kind of a basis for a new mode of segregation that ends up being imposed after the riot, which, they try to get people to go back to their they try to get the indigenous people to go back to the indigenous districts, and they try to get the Spanish people to go back to the center of town. But that doesn't necessarily hold for very long. But what does hold is this kind of attempt to track people's movement through space and movement through the city by using these kinds of census documents that allow them to sort of figure out who's living where. So whereas segregation had previously been a kind of technique that was built into the, the actual like physical space of the city, in the wake of this riot where segregation had broken down, there's a kind of a realization that they need other tools to make segregation continue to work. And this kind of, these kind of tracking or monitoring or surveillance tools are what emerge, as a way to kind of supplement the failure of the infrastructure of segregation, at the end of the 17th century.
So do you see there being, considering these two episodes and I suppose the rest of the empire, do you see there being a narrative of infrastructure and race to follow here? Or are what we're seeing more like reiterations of a certain pattern?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, in some ways, I think I don't want to tell a story in the book where there's a kind of a neat progression from one kind of concentration to the next kind of concentration. So I definitely don't want to argue that, congregation is the first kind of concentration. And then, in chapter two, I talk about another project, which is called Recogimiento, basically the creation of these like disciplinary institutions that are sort of like schools and prisons mixed together. And then in the third chapter, I talk about segregation. And so I'm not trying to say like that, first there's congregation, then there's recogimiento or, enclosure, and then there's segregation. But, I do think that people are drawing on the history of these concentration projects. So in the wake of the 1692 riot, the people who are writing about segregation are referring back to the same laws from the early 16th century that were the ones on which congregation was based, right? And they're using them to, you know, they claim that they're reproducing congregation, but they're just trying to go back to the way things were in the 16th century. But in reality, they're kind of posing something different. And so in a way, I would say, you know, there are important resonances between these different moments and these different kinds of projects. But they also may point to, new crises, new tensions that are emerging at later on, new sort of impasses that have to be resolved. In the late 17th century, there's a lot of new circumstances on the ground, that aren't present in the early 16th century. For example, new kind of like economic arrangements where people are being drawn, indigenous people who had previously maybe lived in these outer districts and had been able to grow crops on their land, either within the city or near the city, are now kind of wage laborers in the center of the city working for Spaniards, or just the changing demographics of the colonial population. So there's these new conditions on the ground. And I guess what I would say in terms of the narrative is that the new conditions create new crises, and people draw on this repertoire that these kind of colonial elites are drawing on, this repertoire that they have of congregation projects, but trying to deploy them in new ways, right? And they end up with these new techniques that maybe work in different ways than they had worked before.
And then in the last chapter, you take a very different turn and look at something quite distinct from these earlier ones. And this is the botanical garden in Madrid and in Mexico City. Why that, and what does that show us that's going on differently here at the end of Spanish rule in Mexico?
Yeah. So the last chapter is really different. One way that I think it's useful to think about is that these infrastructures of concentration, these concentration projects that have been deployed over the course of the colonial period, had generated all sorts of efficiencies in terms of governing, right? But they'd also generated a lot of resistance, and that becomes really clear in this massive riot that happens in 1692. But it had been clear all along because there were people who ran away from their congregated towns. There were people who ran away from their disciplinary institutions. And so there's a sense in which concentration had always been a difficult project to impose. And in the 18th century, a lot changes. One of the things that changes is that there's this kind of new emphasis or interest in classification and taxonomy. And there's a kind of a sense that collecting things, concentrating things, continues to be a really useful form of governance. It continues to be a really useful form of control, but it also is a useful form for generating new knowledge. And so you start seeing things like botanical gardens, right? Which in a way, they kind of serve a similar purpose. They concentrate dispersed objects at centralized locations. And what's maybe different about, and in a similar way, you could say that like the botanical garden, like the, say, congregated town, also serves to facilitate, say, capital accumulation, right? In a different way, but there's a kind of an extraction that happens at both sites. Say in the congregated town, you're getting resources out of the indigenous population. In the botanical garden, you're trying to grow particular crops that you can then kind of commodify and sell, or acclimatize them to be able to grow them in a different place than they had been previously able to be grown in order to generate more revenue. And one thing about concentrating plants is that they don't run away, right? And so there's a kind of a, in a sense, the shift to plants as a sort of object of concentration, resolves one of the main problems that had emerged over the course of, you know, hundreds of years of concentration project, which is the problem of resistance. If you think of, and well, there's another aspect to it too, which is that in this time period in the 18th century in the Enlightenment, there's this, as I kind of mentioned before, there's this kind of new interest in classification, and especially classification of things based on their external characteristics or attributes. And plants are really easy to classify in that sense. And so the critic, Michel Foucault, who's written a lot about this, he says in his book, The Order of Things, that the plants in the 18th century, plants kind of end up being the kind of most important or easiest or most significant or central kind of object around which knowledge starts to be produced. And so there's a way in which centralizing plants and studying plants in the 18th century comes to also be a way of talking about sort of people and race and difference between all living things more generally. So the way that happens is that it has to do with the relation between the kind of thinking about the relation between external factors like environments and the bodies on which they act. So obviously, this is a big problem for people who are trying to sort of take, say, tropical plants and grow them in maybe in Europe, right? There's a lot of interest in growing sort of exotic colonial plants in the sort of botanical gardens in the imperial centers. And obviously, this ends up being a problem because it's really hard to reproduce the climate in which they're accustomed to grow. And so there's a sense in which, you know, there's a need to be able to control the climactic external factors in which these plants are being grown in order to figure out, you know, what is a plant? You know, what makes this plant unique? What is it? What are its characteristics? This chapter, the fourth chapter in the book, looks at the way that the kind of attempts to reproduce different climactic features in the botanical garden in Madrid and in Mexico City as a way of getting at the science of concentration. And I basically argue that at this time, concentration becomes not so much an art of governance, but a science of governance. And it ends up also having kind of a scientific character that not only enables them the generation of new knowledge, but also it kind of becomes to follow particular rules, right? In Madrid, on the one hand, there is a kind of an attempt to replicate colonial environments by using technologies like greenhouses, for example, which doesn't really end up working. In colonial Mexico, in Mexico City, there's an attempt to try to reproduce a wide variety of climates by building the botanical garden on a mountain, which has different sides of the mountain that have received different amounts of sunlight and have different kind of temperatures, average temperatures, and receive different amounts of rainfall. And so there's a kind of there's an attempt to kind of rationalize the relation between external factors, you know, that act on living things and those living things themselves. And in a way, what is kind of comes out of this experience is a kind of a recognition that, or an argument or an assumption that certain kinds of bodies are impervious to the operation of external forces, and other bodies are subject to determination by external forces. And that whole discussion ends up having a lot of importance for thinking about race as well, because at this time, there comes to be a kind of an assumption that certain kinds of people, right, are subject to external determination, while other kinds of people are not subject. They're autonomous, and they are bodies that you know, their bodies have a different kind of substance than the bodies of the colonized population. So that's a long way of kind of getting to the answer about how plants are being made to speak about race in this in the 18th century through projects of concentration that in certain ways depart from, but in other ways resemble this long history of concentration projects that have been going on for hundreds of years.
Hmm. That's fascinating. That's a fascinating part of the book, and one that I certainly want to flag for listeners to read on their own. We're going to be running out of time in a few minutes here, Daniel. Is there anything about the book that we've not covered that you want to make sure is on this recording?
I guess maybe the one thing that I would say really quickly is just that I think that the book kind of emerges as or one of the main interventions that I want to make. You know, so I've talked a lot about like colonial Latin American history and colonial Latin American studies. But there's also a kind of a broader argument about, I guess, about race, like race theory that I want to make in the book. And the argument is really that, there's a kind of a recognition, a conventional recognition today. It's kind of become a common sense that race is socially constructed. There's often a lot of ambiguity about what social construction actually means. And I think there's still a lot of assumptions that race is, maybe a discursive category. It's something that people kind of imagine. It's an idea that then gets applied to particular bodies. And one of the main interventions that I really want to make with the book is to try to insist that the production of race is not something that just happens at a kind of a discursive level. It's not something that just happens in the sphere of ideas, but actually has a material character. This material character has to do with the way that bodies are arranged in space, populations are arranged in space, also the practices that are imposed on those bodies. So like the requirement to sort of pay certain amounts of tribute or perform a certain amount of forced labor would also be productive of race in the sense that race is something new that emerges through domination. The infrastructure of race, the infrastructural character of race becomes really important. It not only has this materiality in that it's built through a kind of material organization of space, right, that weaves colonial space together in really physical ways, but also it ends up functioning materially in that race, after it's been created, continues to reproduce these patterns of domination and accumulation that are enabled by colonial rule.
That's an excellent way to put it, and I suppose a good place to stop. Can you tell me just a little bit about what you're working on since this book has been completed?
Sure. So my new project that I've been working on is also about infrastructure, but rather than being focused on infrastructures that concentrate or contain bodies, I'm writing about infrastructures that facilitate circulation, particularly roads. And so there's a particular road. I'm actually looking at one very specific road in colonial Mexico, which is the road between Mexico City and the port of Veracruz in the late 16th and early 17th century. So why is this road important? It's important because essentially all the commodities that are being extracted from Mexico, all of the silver that's being extracted from Mexico and everything else, all of the commodities that are coming from Europe and the enslaved Africans that are being imported into Mexico, and all of the commodities that are coming from, or a lot of the commodities that are coming from China to Europe that are shipped through the Philippines, which was also a Spanish colony, to Acapulco on the Pacific coast of Mexico, then up through Mexico City to the port of Veracruz, and then on to Europe. All of those commodities from China end up coming along this road as well. Turns out that this road also went through an area that was beginning to have sugar plantations set up on it. And so there were a lot of enslaved Africans who were being relocated to those areas, which also meant that there were a lot of Maroons, right? Escaped slaves running away from the plantations and setting up Maroon communities in the mountains and forests around them. And these Maroons, apparently, during this period, were doing a lot of raids on the wagons that were carrying the commodities along the road. And so the sort of secure circulation, the safe circulation of commodities along this highway, very important commodities, including, you know, the king's silver, essentially. So securing that circulation from robbery, from these kind of like racialized threats that were associated with banditry in this period becomes a really important aspect of colonial rule, and really of the kind of foundation of global commerce in this moment of the initial rise of the world system, the capitalist world system, in the late 16th and early 17th century. So I'm writing about that road, the way that it facilitated circulation, the circulation of commodities in this moment of kind of the rise of capitalism, and the kind of like racialized conflicts that emerge along the road and interrupt, disrupt, expropriate, recuperate those commodities in ways that sort of enable other kinds of life and maybe even freedom to emerge.
I very much look forward to reading that book when that comes out, and I hope I get to interview you about it. Professor Nebzer, thank you so much for your time, and it's been a great interview. Thanks.
It's a pleasure, and thanks for talking to me about it.